This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. And welcome on this 11th day of January 2008, 5 days after the Epiphany, and as we move into a whole new year. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, welcoming you to the program and welcoming my guest, Joseph Ellis. Joseph Ellis, known to many of you for his works on the founding brothers, on Thomas Jefferson, on George Washington, on the creation of our country. He has been called by the New York Review of Books the founder's historian for our time. His most recent book is American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic. He has won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Founding Brothers and the National Book Award for his portrait of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx. He is the Ford Foundation Professor of History at Mount Holyoke College, and he lives in Amherst, Massachusetts, with his wife Ellen and their youngest son, Alex. So, Joe, it's a great pleasure to have you back here on the program.
Really great to be back with you, Duncan.
I have to say, we're here today to take a very long view and a deep view, hopefully, of the current presidential primaries and this whole election season and the election of 2008 in our country from the perspective of its potentially tipping point importance and great significance in our country and in the world, and also to take that kind of perspective that you took in American Creation, where we're seeking to see the deep and complex underpinnings of the political process and how it has come about in our particular country and how that's perceived both in our country and the rest of the world. And so I thought we might begin by just acknowledging the praise that's been received for your most recent book, American Creation, where, as you put it yourself, our founding fathers in America, as they've been called, or you've recalled them, the founding brothers and the founding men and women of the United States, basically have often been lionized or made into larger-than-life figures, seemingly with superhuman abilities and insight. And on the other hand, there's been another school of thought to try to reduce them to ordinary and less-than-ordinary people motivated by things that are quite very much in their self-interest and so on. And you've tried to steer a middle course to see that indeed there were some highly extraordinary events happening in the time and place at that time in history, and some extraordinary people who were able to see and sense that zeitgeist, we might call it, the spirit of the times, as they say, the zeitgeist, and to go with it and to make difficult decisions based on a kind of faith and vision and a sense of an exceptional moment in time offering an exceptional opportunity.
They really did create the first liberal nation state that was rooted in the principle of individual rights, rule of law, separation of church and state, and a kind of legitimate opposition. That is a two-party system in which you didn't kill your opponents or put them on the guillotine, but you argued with them, so that the degree of their triumph is extraordinary. They discovered the recipe for the liberal nation state that will triumph in the 19th and 20th century. But as you're also aware, they failed in some respects, and so the book's talking about triumphs and tragedies. And as you know, the two great failures, as I see it, at least, the failure to end slavery and the failure to reach a just resolution of the Native American question.
And you've called those, in a sense, the original sins of the country that have a stain that still remains, we might say, in the psychic energy field and as we are perceived. around the world. And this particular election coming up seems to have a unique opportunity to do a kind of cleansing of that particular wound and an opening up and a restoration, if you will, of the original vision, a kind of renewal of it. And in this particular regard, I'm thinking of the sense of American exceptionalism. There's a way of looking at that where it is a kind of small-minded hubris or a sense of chauvinism or hyper-patriotism. We're different than everybody else and we're better, and that kind of adolescent attitude. But at a larger, we might say, archetypal or very practical perspective, the exceptionalism of America is quite real. As the founders realized, the piece of land that we live on here has extraordinary resources and is positioned between two oceans in a way that provides a certain kind of security and abundance that's really available in no other country on earth in the same degree. So there's a sense of a stewardship of an exceptional and extraordinary possibility here with the construction, as you say, for the first time in history, of a genuine liberal, open, incipient democratic state. And what I'd like to do is ask you now, as we go into the 21st century, as we've devolved in the last 20 years into a kind of bitter partisanship and kind of fragmentation, the red state, blue state divide, it's reminiscent in a sense, I think a very real sense, of the situation that prevailed at the time when this was just an idea, the Declaration of Independence, and then the 13 years later, in 1789, having the Constitution and nurturing this tiny potential in its infancy into what would become a great nation. And in that time frame, George Washington's main concern was to create a sense of unity, which was almost an impossible task.
It's true. I mean, in the late 18th century, both during the War for Independence and then afterwards, and the adoption of the Constitution and into the 1790s, most Americans did not regard themselves as Americans. They regarded themselves as Virginians or New Englanders or Georgians. The term United States was a plural noun, not a singular noun. The United States are, and it took some time for the different regions, the one's loyalty, in other words, was not to a larger nation called the United States, but to one's local government or local area or region or at best state. And one of Washington's biggest tasks was to try to gradually, of course, because you can't do this quickly, bring Americans together and become the symbol. He himself became the symbol for something, a larger collective. I mean, you know, when you're looking at the kind of divisions that exist in Iraq now, I mean, while our divisions were not ethnic in that same sense or religious in quite that same sense, it does remind us how long it takes to create a larger national sense of identity.
And one of the things I think that is most important here is the recognition here, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side, as the election season begins to unfold, that there are really some of these same issues that confronted the founding fathers, founding brothers, founding men and women of this country that have arisen once again, a kind of bitter political divisiveness, a tendency to go negative in campaigning and misrepresent the other person's opinions, and most importantly, to stoke the fires of fear and uncertainty and make an appeal, we might say, are less idealistic, are less noble natures. And in that particular regard, I'd like to just address this question of unity. Let's start with the Democratic side. One of the things that has been remarked with, for instance, the candidacy of Senator Obama, and it's been remarked repeatedly by commentators, is that his message is one of aspiration, hope, positivity, and this extraordinary ability to appeal across the spectrum of not only just Democrats, but also, and independents, but also Republicans. And we've seen recently comments by major Republican commentators praising his abilities and so on. And what we find here is a statement by Bob Herbert in the New York Times saying, "The historians can put aside their reference material. This is new. America has never seen anything like the Barack Obama phenomenon." He said, Mr. Obama has shown in one appearance after another a capacity to make people feel good about their country again. His supporters want desperately to turn the page on the bitter politics, serial disasters of the past 20 years. They have gravitated to a black candidate to carry this task. This, to use a term I've heard for the first time this week, is momentous. Not only is it momentous, but this is the first time there has been what they call a viable black candidate who could actually win the race. Now, what does this represent in terms of our history, going back to, as you say, that original sin of slavery, which has never been completely expunged from our national psyche?
I tend to agree with the thrust of Mr. Herbert's remark in that Obama's central message is to bring us together. And I think when he talks about bringing the red states and the blue states together, it's an interesting way of only obliquely talking about bringing both blacks and whites together, too, because he's not a kind of self-consciously racially oriented candidate. I also think that in some sense you might see his serious candidacy, meaning that he has a legitimate chance at becoming elected president of the United States. This is the first black candidate for whom this is possible. I think Shirley Chisholm ran 30 years ago now, but Obama is quite a serious candidate indeed, and this is the first time in the history of the Republic where that is the case. And we might very well read it as the ultimate fulfillment of the original American promise made by Jefferson in the Declaration, carried forward to end slavery by Lincoln, carried forward to end racial discrimination in public facilities by Martin Luther King, and now a black candidate who might very well become the leader of the entire nation. In some sense, I think the founders would regard this as the culmination of an experiment that they began over 200 years ago. And I think that there's some truth in also suggesting that Hillary Clinton's candidacy at the same time represents an analogous situation. There's never really been a serious possibility of a woman president. And so on the Democratic side, on both leading candidates, we have epical, historically unprecedented context situations right now.
And it all seems to me to be connected to this narrative of unity, you know, how the campaigns are run and how they are perceived. One of the things that's extraordinary here that Michael Powell in the New York Times has said about the Obama campaign is that he has made in his speeches a sense of historical moment that we can make history. He says, and I quote, by turning the nation's sorrowful racial narrative into something radiant and hopeful. Now, this would have been almost unimaginable to the founders.
Yes, it would. It would. I mean, when I talk about this being the fulfillment of their original promise, that's true, but it's one that they could not act on themselves.
Yes.
And, that the belief that blacks and whites could live together in the same society was very difficult for them to imagine. And this is one of the, you know, the, as we say, original sins, but I don't think, short of a couple hundred thousand frontal lobotomies, you're going to be able to make a change on that score.
Not in that.
We have now evolved and moved forward. And this really is a kind of truly dramatic moment. And this unity theme, as I listen to Obama, I hear the cadences of Martin Luther King and the message of John Fitzgerald Kennedy brought together. I think he's not afraid to ask us to make sacrifices, which I think is a good sign. And he's not making promises that he's going to solve every problem in the world. I think this notion of bringing us together is extremely attractive to a great many Americans.
and it may actually be essential for the survival of the American project. One of the things that you, I think, document in a very extraordinary way in your new book, American Creation, is how close the American experiment came again and again to failing. And had it not been for instance, some extraordinary events, which George Washington even went so far as to attribute to Providence,
right.
They were so unlikely that nurtured the possibilities for even surviving as a nation in our infancy. And if it were not for Washington making difficult and painful personal decisions on the very issues you're talking about, we would not be here. And by
that's
that,
right.
I mean Washington, as you point out, had fought in the French Indian Wars, had a very close experience on the battlefield and respect for Native Americans. The same thing, he was in an extraordinary position as the head of the Continental Army, where basically many of the soldiers were poor white and poor black people that were not actually in the normal strata of society that the other founders moved in. And so he had an experience of something that really transcended race, transcended class, and he saw the possibility and indeed the huge necessity for bringing all of these energies together if the experiment were even to survive. And we might say, I think, without hyperbole, that we're back in that same situation again today, that the bitter fragmentation and polarization that we've experienced in the last 20 years in our politics has been tremendously debilitating and exhausting, and it has actually lowered our respect around the world and thus our possibility to bring forth whatever gift this nation has in its peculiar personal history to give to the world. And so if we look at these candidacies now, we're going to get on to Hillary Clinton in a moment, but let's just finish here with the Barack Obama candidacy. He got the endorsement of John Kerry, who incidentally is my old college debate partner. So I know him, and I was very interested to see his speech, which was unusually powerful and passionate. In fact, it was remarked by one of the commentators that this was the John Kerry of old, when he was younger and passionate and idealistic, and who had felt constrained since then by continually running for office. And he had an opportunity here to express his own deeper aspirations, and he said, and I quote, "I support Obama because he does not seek to perfect the politics of swift voting, but to end it. I support Barack Obama because he will bring the country together again, lead the world, and show by example, not by words, that here in America, anything is really possible for those who dare to dream." So in a sense, he's cutting through this sort of more petty debate about words versus action. Everybody knows that you have to have action, but you also have to have words that inspire. But in the end of the day, what Kerry is suggesting here is the mere fact that America might elect a black man in itself will send a message not only to the rest of the country, but to the rest of the world, because he's not running on a we might say, divisive agenda as a black man. This is not a black man who's running black versus white, who's playing the race card. This is someone who's actually trying to go beyond the race card. And that's what was meant by Michael Powell when he said, we could turn this sad narrative of our slavery into something that is inspirational so that the country can heal and go beyond that. What do you think about that Kerry endorsement?
I think he's right. I think that the world would regard the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States as an extraordinary statement about what's possible in the United States.
And in their own countries. That was his suggestion.
Right, right. I think that, I mean, I want to lay all my cards on the table here. I am a Barack supporter. I think I need to be detached when we're talking history here, but I'm quite committed, and my own eldest son is working for him and was working for him in New Hampshire. So, there's no question that he wants to bring us together both racially and regionally and ideologically, and that at least for the last 8 years, the Rovian theory of election was to not go to the center and bring people together, but go to the margins of your base, in his case, evangelical Christians and corporate America, and then win the election by half a percentage point, and then govern from that position. And you know, while Bush promised us to be a compassionate conservative, he certainly has governed from the right, and he promised not to become policeman of the world. And after 9/11, we find ourselves mired in a quagmire in Iraq, and so in some sense, you know, I think historically we're going to look at the last 8 years as a kind of political and, in fact, foreign policy aberration, and Obama's wanting to bring us back to a kind of conversation as Americans that, at least for the last 8 years, has been shunned, and also a conversation with other nations in the world, including nations that we don't agree with, like Iran. I'm feeling extremely optimistic about the fact whether or not Obama wins, he's created something new in American politics.
And in fact, we might call it the kite runner effect, you know, after that hugely popular novel and the new movie, where the key point begins in the novel when the protagonist, who's now an adult and a refugee in Marin County, gets a call from his mentor and his father's friend from 30 years ago when he's had been a child, you know, back in Afghanistan. And the man says to him, "Come back now. There is a way to be good again." And here we see in Frank Rich's column last Sunday, his epiphany column on January 6th in the New York Times, he said, "After so many years of fear and loathing, we had almost forgotten what it's like to feel good about our country." The same thing was remarked upon by Bob Herbert. And now Gail Collins in the New York Times had this to say. She said, "The Democratic contest is extremely unusual for an American election in that it contains more than one viable option. Barack Obama turns out to have a positive genius for making moderation sound exciting and is perhaps the only politician in American history who can get a crowd all worked up with a call to politeness. We can disagree without being disagreeable," he said in his New Hampshire farewell, drawing a roar of approval. And so I think there's a nerve there that's very important. It's the power of rhetoric. We could go all the way back to Dante in Italy and the Divine Comedy, and his vision of hell or inferno was full of people that today we would call political consultants or false statesmen who had smooth talk but did not have talk that really fired you up or inspired you to actually go beyond self-interest in a way that was empowering to the people rather than empowering to the leaders. And then he had to go through purgatory, as we know, up to paradise in that great book, The Divine Comedy. And so a purgation, some kind of recognition that there is something that is underpinning our collective that needs to be dealt with, which is this spirit of negativity and divisiveness, that until we do that and purge that and the stain of what you might call this original sin, the true energy and possibility that's here cannot be liberated. And so now let's turn our attention to Hillary Clinton and to John Edwards, and how do you see their candidacies in the light of these historical perspectives? We do see something unique here in the possibility of Obama. What do we see that's unique and relates to these themes in Hillary Clinton and in John Edwards?
I think to some extent, Hillary Clinton's viable candidacy, no question about it, makes me go back to the letter that Abigail Adams wrote to John on March 31st, 1776. It's a famous letter. It's called "Remember the Ladies." And in that, she suggests that the very ideas that Adams and his colleagues at the Continental Congress had been hurling at George III in Parliament had implications for the relationship between men and women, too, and that it implied at least a level of equality both politically and within the family that John himself was not prepared to acknowledge. In effect, the implications of that ideology are now staring us right in the face with Hillary Clinton as one of the front runners on the Democratic side. So, you know, first it was Seneca Falls, then it was the vote, and then the civil rights movement to bring women as well as blacks into the conversation. And now, you know, gender as much as race has been a stain or the way in which discrimination and patriarchal values have dominated our culture. And I think it's impossible to have imagined either a Barack Obama or a Hillary Clinton in this position 20, 25 years ago. So this is really, we're crossing some kind of threshold here.
And I saw some Latin American commentators recently had said it would be a good thing either way. If we saw a woman in the White House in the United States, that would be very good. But we already have actually women in Chile and Argentina. If we were to see a brown face in the White House, that would be revolutionary. So there are people around the world that are going to be affected by this election one way or the other. And I think that one of the things that we need to address here as we move on here to the Republicans is this shadow that was cast over the New Hampshire election. There was, as we know, exit polling that took place on the Republican side and on the Democratic side by the same pollsters, and they were exactly accurate on the Republican side, but they were way off on the Democratic side. Now, we're not talking about polling prior to the election, but we're talking about exit polling. And this raises some uncomfortable things that, again, there have been articles in the New York Times that I think we need to face. One of them is that there could have been, and most likely was, according to these commentators, a hidden racial factor, the shadow side of our national wound. And also, even more so, Dennis Kucinich has come out today and asked for a recount, suggesting that there may have been some way that people were able to manipulate the voting machines there. Now, we don't want to spend too much time on these two things, but we want to acknowledge that there are also underbellies here in our electoral process which reflect the kind of things that happened at the founding of our nation and how people were not always completely full of integrity at the way they dealt with the voting process. Perhaps you'd like to address those two things.
The polls, eight separate polls, four of them quite distinguished pollsters, regarded Obama on the eve of the election as having between an 8 and a 13-point lead, and the exit polls confirmed that. And very distinguished pollsters have never seen something like this, where all of them were wrong, and wrong in a big way. Even though Obama lost by a very narrow margin, nevertheless, that's a swing of 10%, which is unheard of. And there's the kind of boo-hoo explanation to what that right before the election, Hillary had an emotional moment. She didn't really cry, but there's a moment of honesty and emotional vulnerability that might have influenced a good many older women voters who did turn out in a greater number than anticipated for Hillary. I think that we have to also hold open the very real possibility that polls that are polls for black candidates, as Obama is, have a history of overrepresenting his votes because people, especially working class whites, will often be unwilling to acknowledge that they simply cannot vote for a black man. And so we don't know the answer to this, but if I were to follow it through, I would say that we have to face the fact that even though we've ended slavery, even though we've put civil rights in place, even though this is a serious black candidate that a large number of New Hampshire and Iowa whites have voted for, and I mean, both of those states are 97-98% white, so those are all things to be applauded, there is probably still a residual racism present in the society that we really simply cannot ignore.
And in fact, that was a very serious piece yesterday by Andrew Kohut in the New York Times. He's the president of the Pew Research Center, and we can recommend that people go to that, where he said from his own experience with David Dinkins in New York City that he was up by a margin of victory of 15 in their polls, and he ended up being elected by a 2% margin. And that's something that Andrew Kohut experienced personally. And then there was Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia, another very highly respected pollster who had been intimately involved in 1989. With the Doug Wilder election in Virginia itself.
Right.
Yeah, which had the same thing, where he was way ahead, 52% to 41% on the exit poll, and then he turned out to win by 50.2% to 49.8%. So what Andrew Kohut said is that he found that oftentimes that the people that you described do not respond to surveys and tend to have a more unfavorable view of blacks, I'm quoting, than respondents who do the interviews. And it's not so much because respondents were lying to our interviewers, although that may have happened, but because poor, less well-educated voters were less likely to agree to answer our questions, and therefore they tried to provide for that in their estimations. But in his case, in New York City, with the election of David Dinkins, he was way off by about 13% because of this hidden factor. So he concludes that there is this shadow race factor that is simply there.
Just two quickies on this, Duncan. That is, I think that one of the things he's saying is that when pollsters ask people a question, they indicate they're open to, let's say, in this case, an Obama choice, when in fact they really aren't.
Right.
And, so that the polls don't accurately reflect their opinion. Secondly, one of the reasons this did not show up at all in Iowa is that Iowa wasn't really an election. It was a series of caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
So voters didn't get to go into a booth, close the curtain, and make their choice unknown. They had to argue it out publicly. And in that kind of public situation, an overtly racist position is unacceptable.
That's right. And one of the things that this discussion does is illuminate how interesting it's going to be to watch both Nevada and South Carolina now as they come up, because Nevada is a caucus state and South Carolina is a primary state where you have secret ballot and so on, as they did in New Hampshire. The other thing that's very interesting about South Carolina, it has been often said that 50% of registered Democrats in South Carolina are African American. But also another way of looking at it is that 30% of registered Democratic electors are African American women. So these two wounds that we're talking about, the slavery wound and the gender wound, will be coming together in that particular primary in a way that should be a real bellwether of how this may play out in the rest of the election. So that's just something to really be aware of.
I think what I've seen thus far is that up until Iowa, a great many black voters suggested they really would find it difficult to believe that a predominantly white nation would actually select a black man to be their leader. And after Iowa, which is, again, 97-98% white, and even New Hampshire, which he lost, but barely, I mean, you've got to suggest that there are an awful lot of white voters who are quite willing to vote for Barack Obama. And I think that makes a difference in the Carolina election, because I really think that the blacks, for the first time, think that they really do have a potential winner, not just some sort of Jesse Jackson candidacy that allows them to express their frustration.
In fact, I think that's going to be one of the most interesting things in the entire election, because this will be the first time we'll really have an opportunity to gauge that, not only in the pre-polls, but most, or even in the exit polls, but in the actual results.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not this pattern continues that was observed in New Hampshire, this disturbing pattern, we will begin to see as we go through these other elections. And we're putting aside for the moment the point raised by Kucinich that there still are a number of voting machines in New Hampshire, all through New England and elsewhere in the country, that are not secure in terms of our voting. So that raises a sense of wonder, well, what could have factored into a seemingly very anomalous result? So if we continue to get a pattern of very anomalous results, as happened with John Kerry himself, you recall in Ohio, that his camp did not allow themselves to be enthusiastic that he may have won the November 2004 election until after the exit polls came in. And then it was once again this huge anomaly between what the exit polls showed after people had voted and what the count actually showed in a Republican state where the Secretary of State was in charge of the electoral process, a Republican Secretary of State. So this kind of insecurity about being able to trust our vote, I think, is also something that we have to keep an eye on as this primary system goes forward. The caucus system is self-regulating, as you say, because people are in a room with each other and you can't fudge that. But I think there's a very serious concern here that has been raised in the past, and they say they were trying to deal with it, but we're finding that a lot of people didn't pay a lot of attention to it. And so,
well, South Carolina will be really interesting because it's going to be the first state where there's actual election, where there's a significant black vote. There, you know, New Hampshire and Iowa, negligible black presences. And it's going to be very interesting because there's, you know, many blacks up until recently have regarded Bill Clinton as the first black president. In fact, Clinton was, I think, inducted into the Arkansas African American Hall of Fame. So that he's regarded as a champion, and Hillary, I think, benefits from that. Black women are going to have an interesting choice to make.
Well, it's also going to be, and we'll switch to this topic now, the old and the new, the establishment and the true change is another one of the themes that has been coming up in these primaries. And before we get into that, just want to let our listeners know that I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and I'm speaking with my guest, Joseph Ellis, called The Founder's Historian by the New York Review of Books, author of many books on the creation of our country, the most recent of which is named American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic, said by the Boston Globe and the New York Times Book Review to be something that will be read by many. It will be a certain bestseller, and it's a tremendous goldmine of all the work you've done, Joe, to really educate us as to what the historical events are that continue to percolate through our society and can really illuminate some of the things that at times may seem confusing in the present. And that's why we're addressing this topic of the presidential primaries with Joe from that perspective.
Well, I just want to put a word in for you. I think that I've come on your program many times now, and it's in part because I really think that the kind of conversations that I want to have, you've been able to provide a framework for those. And sometimes those of us on the East Coast think that the only place in America are, you know, that old New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah, Saul Steinberg cartoon.
Yeah, I'm very thankful to you for allowing me to talk to the people of the Rocky Mountain area.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. I mean, I really appreciate that because, indeed, you know, things have changed over time. That Saul Steinberg cartoon we're referring to is where you go, you know, 11th Street, 12th Street, 13th Street, San Francisco. You know,
right.
And indeed, you know, the conversation that's happening out here in the West is a very powerful conversation because we are here in Colorado, what is known as a purple state. We've just gotten a Democratic governor instead of a Republican governor. And in the 2006 elections, we also got a Democratic-controlled Senate and Congress for the first time in many years, as opposed to Republican-controlled. So the Democratic Convention will be here in Denver, and it represents the power of the West at this point to represent the significance that it represents, a way where the blue states and the red states hopefully could find common ground and come together. They call it a purple state. And it's one that's not, you know, sort of set in its ways as some of the so-called red and blue states are. And so these themes are very much on the minds of people out here. And I think they could have a very important effect, as we know, on the election itself. So there's an interesting segue here that we could make from what we've talked about so far. We could move over to the Republican side and see their concern with national security, their concern with what they call fiscal conservatism, and what they call their concern with social conservatism. Now, how do we see the Republican Party and its current position and its current candidates through this historical lens, Joe?
Well, I think that the Republican Party has its work cut out for it because the Bush administration has taken America to further to the right than the American people as a whole prefer, and I don't think any of the major Republican candidates is asking George Bush to appear with them or embracing him. I do think that the shadow of 9/11 remains a larger influence on the Republican side of the argument, and certainly Giuliani's entire candidacy is based on some response to that. And I think that Huckabee is apparently an extraordinarily likable guy. And
even the hard, cynical press has acknowledged that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
they can't dismiss him as just
a
lightweight.
Humor.
Yeah, he's got a sense of humor.
Yeah. He seems to be very comfortable in his own skin. But his constituency is the evangelical constituency. Are we prepared to think that we could have a president who doesn't believe in evolution and who thinks that the world was created in 4004 B.C.? I hope I'm not being prejudicial here, but I do think that that's a problem. I think that the neocon position now means in foreign policy is also a real problem for them because Iraq is a calamitous failure and an extremely costly failure in both lives and treasure. And to embrace that, McCain himself, you know, believes we're winning there. And I think I'm showing my own political colors here a little bit too much, but If the Democrats lose this presidential election, they're never going to win an election again in all of American history.
And spoken as an historian, well, you know, that's where this sense of the unity as opposed to the divisiveness, I think, is so important. That when John Kerry, for instance, was backing Barack Obama yesterday, he said this is a person who's not coming into the race to perfect swift voting, but to eliminate it. So mm-hmm. we can only hope that this will be seen clearly by all the candidates, that the move toward negativity, the move toward misrepresenting others' positions on issues, while it may have some short-range benefits, could have disastrous long-range benefits for the country. And here I want to quote, interestingly enough, George Washington. This is from a book by Jacob Needleman called The American Soul, Rediscovering the Wisdom of the Founders. And here he quotes from George Washington's farewell address. And he says, "Observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all." And for nations here, we might suggest substituting political parties. "Religion and morality enjoin this conduct. We should have peace and harmony with all. And can it be said that good policy does not equally require it? It will be worthy of a free, enlightened, and at no distant period a great nation to give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence." And here's his practical application of that sentiment. "Who can doubt that in the course of time and things, the fruits of such a plan of cultivating peace and harmony would richly repay any temporary advantages which might be lost by not adhering to it? Can it be that Providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue? The experiment, at least, is recommended by every sentiment which ennobles human nature. It is, alas, rendered impossible by its vices. So we should always cultivate just and amicable feelings towards all, and not indulge in habitual hatred or habitual fondness on either side, because it makes us, to some degree, a slave to animosity rather than affection." End of quote.
For most of our history, up until the 1970s, it was required by law that the farewell address by Washington be read out loud on Washington's birthday in the Congress of the United States.
And for good reason. And I think what they also should do, actually, is to perhaps think about reinvigorating that tradition, bringing it back. And what about Lincoln's speech, "The House Divided" in 1858? An extraordinary document, again, of the other great person. We've got the Washington Monument at one end of the mall, and we've got the Lincoln Memorial there.
I think the Lincoln speech that's even more on point for you there, I think the House Divided speech in 1858 is a good one. But the second inaugural, with malice towards none, with charity towards all, and you know, at a moment in time when we've just got through slaughtering each other, over 600,000 fatalities, and basically saying both sides pray to the same God, and both, you know, both are claiming to have justice, and so to be able to reach across that regional and divide is an extraordinary act on his part rhetorically, and I think that. You know, Obama's in that Washington-Lincoln tradition, saying that, and you know, and if you just said it without some of the inspirational rhythms that he brings, it almost sounds Pollyannish, and you know, we can all come together, and he gives it a vitality and a plausibility somehow, and I think that. You see all the candidates on both sides beginning to try to duplicate his rhetoric. Certainly Hillary's doing that, and even on the Republican side. I mean, he's on to something.
Well, I called it the Zeitgeist earlier. You know, in German, Zeit means time and Geist means spirit. So there's the spirit of the times, like, you know, the very same wind that lifted the kites in The Kite Runner. There's a wind at our back here. There's possibility that people had never really taken seriously in the depression of the last 20 years that we could actually feel good again about the country. We could go beyond divisiveness. We could actually ourselves engage once again in the political process. As Obama said, we can make government cool again. So new people coming to the process is very rejuvenating. And the real question here is how we're going to conduct the process as we go forward so that we emerge stronger rather than weaker at the end of this primary season so that the election can be engaged at a higher level. And that's where I think the use of rhetoric, which was so important, let's say, in the time of Dante in Italy, in bringing a fragmented series of small fiefdoms together into ultimately a unity of a larger nation state. Rhetoric has been understood in the Lincoln era when he was having his debates with Stephen Douglas, where people would walk into the fields with their whole families and a picnic and sit and listen to them have substantive back and forth discussion in a mutually respectful way for up to 4 hours. As opposed to a soundbite, which is misleading and deliberately deceptive, which can be purchased with a lot of money from corporate lobbyist donors to try to manipulate the already short attention span of an electorate.
What about the suggestion that I would, you know, this is, I know, never going to work, but let's pass a law, Duncan, that says that all presidential candidates and presidents have to write all their major speeches themselves. This is one of the traditions from the founders. You know, Washington wrote that address, although Hamilton helped him with it, and Lincoln certainly wrote his speeches. Mm-hmm. I think the last president of the United States to write his own speeches was Woodrow Wilson. And Obama has written two books that are his books. They weren't ghost-written, and I'm sure he's got people, speechwriters, but I think that we need to hear the voice of the candidate and not the voice, the canned voice of, you know, a gang of professional rhetoricians.
That's very interesting because it's been remarked about Obama himself that he doesn't do well with other people's material.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, now that Hillary Clinton has said that in New Hampshire, she famously said, "I have found my voice." Let's see.
I found my voice by listening to you.
Yes. And so this remarked a departure from the traditional political style. And now we will see if she can then carry that through into action or whether there will still be these scripted speeches that really don't inspire in the same way as you say, when the voice is actually your own that's coming through. And we look back to the tradition of oratory that was so extraordinary in the 1960s. We look at Martin Luther King. We look at Bobby Kennedy. We look at Malcolm X. We look at John Kennedy. We heard oratory that was incredibly stirring, but most of it came directly from the candidates themselves. JFK had help, obviously, from people like Ted Sorensen and others,
right.
But mostly he spoke with his own spirit infusing the speech. And one of the congressmen from New Hampshire, who happens to be supporting Obama, said, "Sometimes I call it the Democratic Party disease, where there'll be a whole laundry list of issues, policies that, you know, we need to attack the corporations, we need to attack, you know, the this industry, that industry, so on. But there's not a unifying theme of something positive that people can vote for. It's more like voting against."
Mm-hmm.
And this needs to come into balance, because if people read the Declaration of Independence, one of the things that's very interesting about it is we always remember Jefferson's ennobling language, where he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed with certain inalienable rights by their Creator, including the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." That one phrase is quoted again and again, but actually over two-thirds of the document is a very specific list of complaints against King George and an
right.
explanation and evidence why we were going to this extraordinary lengths of having a revolution at all. He said how extraordinary it is in human history because people are willing to put up, as this country actually has put up with a lot of divisiveness and exploitation and a plutocracy for many years now. But at a certain point, there comes a time where you have to say no. That's what Jefferson was saying. In a sense, this balance of specific proposals, but without that overarching vision of inspiration and unity, they somehow become fragmented and dry and not nearly as potent, because without inspiring the people to feel that they can actually participate and make a difference, you become really a consumer society in politics as much as we are in commodities.
Words that you quoted, "We hold these truths," those 55 words are the most important words in American history, and they will be the most influential words in modern history. And they snuck by the attention of the other delegates of the Second Continental Congress, who focused on the other portions of the document. And those words are the American promise and the American creed, and we can read different meanings into them, but Jefferson's words are the words that provide the core of the American liberal tradition, and I mean liberal in the long-term sense of it. And while Jefferson himself was not a great speaker or orator, in fact, he was very shy and had a very sort of weak voice, his crafting of language and Lincoln's crafting of language allows for rhetoric to be more than rhetorical, but to express deep emotions and ideas. And I back to my earlier thing, a candidate who's capable of that, it can touch parts of our soul that no one else can.
And so let's go back to Franklin Roosevelt, where Franklin Roosevelt, in his intimate fireside chats on the radio at a time of tremendous crisis, he spoke intimately to, and personally, we might say, to the American people by saying in ringing tones, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And so now we seem to be in a media-driven, consultant-driven, plutocracy-funded situation where the appeal to fear been really dominant in our politics for quite a number of years now, and that fear has a very different effect on the electorate than inspiring them to their positive possibilities. And so let's take a look here at the Republican side of things, since the current administration has exploited this particular sentiment.
Wouldn't it have been great if President Bush got up after 9/11 and said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself"? But that's not what happened.
Yeah, actually, we have nothing to fear but the absence of fear, because then people might not be as easily manipulable. But so take this a little further now in terms of how that historically was so important, because the fear was extraordinarily real at the time of the founding of our country. In fact, it's almost impossible to imagine the courage that the people who helped found this country had, because they were, as they put it, pledging not only their sacred honor, but their personal treasure and even their lives to this cause.
We need to recover that. I mean, the likelihood of the United States defeating the greatest military power in the world, Great Britain, was apparently remote, and the likelihood of being able to cohere as a series of United States was regarded as impossible by all the pundits and European experts of the age. And there's a moment when they just finished drafting the Declaration and sending it off to the printer, and Benjamin Harrison, the representative from Virginia, meets Elbridge Gerry, representative from Massachusetts, who unfortunately gets gerrymandering named after him, and says, "You know, I'm lucky, Mr. Gerry, because I'm big and fat, and when they catch me and they hang me, I'm going to die quickly, but you're spindly, and you're going to twist in the wind for a long time." Again, it recovers some sense of the real, this was a real dangerous moment, a vulnerable moment, and the people that made those decisions were really risking everything. When Washington left Mount Vernon in May of 1775, the last thing he said was, "When they come and burn my estate down, make sure you get my books and Martha out," not necessarily in that order. And So it helps us to regain some sense of how risky everything was back then. And, I mean, again, I'm not going to try to belittle the terrorist attacks, but in the great scheme of American national security, that is not a threat to the viability of the republic. And I think that they've been, instead of trying to bring us together and quenching fear, we've done exactly the opposite. The press has contributed to that, too. I think we need to get more sensible and more calm and more realistic. I think the global warming is a greater threat to American national security than terrorism.
And that's where I think we really need to take the long view. As the quotation from Washington's farewell address that we spoke earlier says, you can't go for this short-term kind of approach. If you do, you're going to have very much long-term problems. I say that in a very prosaic way, and he said it in a very elegant and inspiring way. But what it means is that we have to actually have the energy field, we might say, of the country unified and pointed toward the kind of innovation and energetic involvement of all of our citizens and all parts of it, Republican, Democratic, financial, creative, social, all these elements working together, as they did in World War II under the leadership of Roosevelt, to actually eliminate the underlying cause of the conflict rather than try to overpower it with a fear-based kind of military response. And so with that, we need to conclude this program. I want to thank very much Joseph Ellis, our guest, to the author of American Creation, called by the New York Times Book Review the founder's historian, for this extremely interesting historical perspective on both the possibilities and the pitfalls of what we're all living through now in 2008. His most recent book is called American Creation: Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding. And so as we've suddenly run out of time here, Joe Ellis, I just want to say you certainly were a very deserving winner of the Pulitzer Prize for your prior book on the Founding Brothers, and this is another great, great read. You've been called the founder's historian for our time, and rightly so, and what a pleasure it's been to spend this time with you.
Thank you very much, Duncan. It's really my pleasure.
And I'll remind our audience that I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. You've been listening to Living Dialogues. Be with us again next time. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, that's living, DIALOGUES.com. You can contact me at duncan@personallifemedia.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.